What we're going to do is put it on our website, and then people, like shut-ins and so on, can listen to it that way. And it picks up.
Will it pick up other?
Generally, yes. It's been doing a pretty good job. It's sort of like new electronics is very good.
Now, is that better than just laying a laptop down here? So I had on Tuesday, I gave a talk, and somebody just put a laptop.
I don't know.
Better than that?
I don't know because I haven't tried it that way. But this seems to work pretty well. I did. Yes, I just turned on.
Well, welcome again to the Longmont Dharma Study Group. Let's go around and hear everybody's name. We don't really have a time for everybody's story. I'm terribly sorry, but smaller groups we do that. But just let's hear everybody's name, because I want to know the names, and there's newcomers here, and obviously the Longmont people want to know your name. Get it written down. You got a clipboard to send around?
Yes. Well, in fact, let me just take a moment for that kind of an announcement. Yep. There is a sign-up sheet on the table by the door. Oh, it's right there. And so it'd be nice if you put your name on it. And if you want to be on our email list, put your email address on there too, and we'll add you. That's up to you completely. My name is Eric, and I'm the brand new coordinator of this group as of this last Sunday.
Oh,
congratulations.
Yeah.
It was a cool Sunday.
All right.
Good choice.
Okay. So, and maybe, we're going to go around the name. Eric?
I'm Michael.
I'm Michael.
I'm Rebecca.
Hi, John.
Hi, John. I'm Elaine Logan. And in Scotland, that's how we introduce ourselves.
I'm Barbara.
Hi, Barbara.
I'm Jackie.
I'm Cody.
Hey.
I'm Diane.
Hi.
I'm Christy.
Hi, Christy.
I'm Scott.
We got two Scots now.
I'm Rissa. I'm
doing good here.
I'm Aubrey.
Aubrey.
Carol.
Carol.
My name's Shaw.
Yeah. Okay, and there's someone else who's here that we're not seeing. I don't see his picture. And so I want to mention the founder of this Shambhala lineage. His name is Chögyam Trungpa. If we had more time, I would say more about him. But he was born in 1939. Was highly educated and whatnot in the Tibetan tradition of lamas. He felt it necessary to leave Tibet when the Chinese presence was intensified in 1959. Came to North America, 10 years in studying English, including a long time in England and a smaller time in Scotland. And then came to North America in 1971 and began teaching and having learned English as his avenue into talking to us, basically. He began to write books, and this book in my hand is entitled Shambhala, The Sacred Path of the Warrior. And there's a couple more over there in that little cabinet you can look at afterwards. And I have a picture of him here. Interestingly, he gave up Tibetan attire in favor of Savile Row and other fancy clothing establishments. And there he is in his beautiful suit, and just pass it around. So that shows you who we are really attached to here in terms of teachings. He's the one that said it's good to sit on the square gamden, the square cushion. And his son is now in charge of the Shambhala lineage. And Darn, I didn't bring one with a picture of him. Has somebody got the Ruling Your World handy?
We could pass it over there. Let me see.
We could pass that around because he's got a nice picture on the cover.
Okay.
His son was born in India after the trek to India, and he was educated in many places around the world, both in Western high schools and in Eastern ashrams and whatnot, so he knows all the worlds that we could inhabit and knows how to bridge the gap. And what I want to talk about tonight, so I actually have a topic of conversation for us here, is this book, in his most recent book, I believe. So that's, he goes by the name of, at least he writes books under the name of Sakyong Mipham, as you'll see on the cover there. And this book, Shambhala Principle, is his most recent writing. And it's a story about how we could integrate meditation with worldly concerns, with our, you know, friendships, relationships, in the larger picture of political and social contexts, could all be approached by the same idea as that we approach meditation with. So I'm going to pass this around to you just get a look at that book. And that book can be read from start by anyone. It doesn't have any prerequisites or excessive jargon that isn't explained. And so I definitely offer that. The idea of reading that as a good follow-up. We're going to talk about one chapter of that book tonight. So my title here is entitled, Cheer Yourself Up. What's that got to do with meditation? Anything, whatever? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
Well, if I can get present, then I can get cheery.
Okay, well, that's, yeah, if you can get present, you can get cheery. So here's a quote from the maybe the first paragraph of that chapter. It says, be where you are and who you are. That's how to cheer yourself up.
What, you said chapter, first chapter of what?
Chapter 11, Bankrupt.
The Shambhala Principle.
Oh, the Shambhala Principle. Yeah. Okay.
See, the chapter begins by he woke up depressed one day. His father noticed, and then they started talking about depression and its antidote, cheer up. So, let's see, was you said that, right?
If I can get present, then I can get cheery.
Yeah. So, what do you think of this little thing? Be where you are. And who you are, that's how to cheer yourself up. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I find that when I'm... Meditation has just kind of taught me... Not taught me, but it's teaching me to be in the present. And when I'm not, that's when... It's like when I'm in the past, it's anxiety. Not anxiety. In the past, I'm in depression. In the future, I'm in anxiety.
Yeah, you nailed it right there. Past depression, right. Future anxiety.
But if I'm right now...
If you're totally you're checked out, then what?
Right?
Yeah, you know, if you're daydreaming about something or you're off Never Never Land, so you're...
Yeah, I can really relate to the part about being who you are, because I recently realized through my mindfulness and awareness that, like, I was having emotions or feelings, and then I wasn't just letting myself be. I wasn't allowing it and accepting it, but I was compounding the negative, so-called negative or painful emotions that were rising by making them not okay, or even anxiety by making it not okay. And I had this final, this experience the other night, because I had intended to let it be, and I was in bed having my normal potential nighttime anxiety thoughts about Y and Z, and I said, no, I'm not going to make going to let it be, and I swear, it just passed through when I went to sleep.
Can you repeat that every night, or is it?
Yeah, no, yeah. It was like 3 nights ago. So far, it's been pretty good.
Can you bottle it? And he goes on to say that his father, so this is basically a son writing about his father and what he learned from him. So it's about our two lineage holders. He said some other people asked him how to cheer up, and his answer was, "You just have to do it." I was in a talk he gave one time that the father, Chogyam Trungpa, gave to at least 200 people. And there was the main part of the talk seemed to be question and answer. And somebody said, "Well, you know, we're having a little problem with marriage, and how do you make all these wonderful ideas of meditation? How do you make that work in a marriage?" And Trungpa sat there for a while, and then he kind of looked up and said, "You just have to do it." So that seemed to be some idea of cheerfulness. And there's a definition in there that depression is the vanguard of obstacles and negativity, and cheerfulness guards against complication and adversity. And I think you were talking about complication. Weren't you? Sort of.
Yeah, cheerfulness guards against it?
Yes, against complication and adversity.
Right, cheerfulness.
And it's interesting, he doesn't say it in this chapter, but Trungpa planted the suggestion that holidays could be cheerful instead of happy. Like, you know,
birthdays.
You know you're really in the inner circle if somebody tells you cheerful birthday instead of happy birthday. Then you've arrived.
Okay.
And I think the idea here again is that cheerfulness has a path quality. That, you know, we can do something about it. We can, well, choose to be cheerful or not. Whereas, kind of hard to choose to be happy. So this is one of these cases where I would say the path is the goal. The path could be cheerfulness, and the goal, cheerfulness. How do you get there? By being cheerful. You just have to do it. We're going to look into it a little bit more. It's not a joke. It's not. It sounds facetious to say that, but really, there is something to it. And what we have to do to talk about this is we have to look at meditation itself, how these things arise in meditation, and then how they arise in post-meditation. So this could be a little introduction to post-meditation. I would say that, except that we've all been involved in post-meditation all our life, even before we meditated. I mean, post-meditation means facing life on a, as you say, now basis. Not past, not future, but actually facing life directly right now. That's the kind of post-meditation objective. The next question on here is, what is depression? Anybody want to take a stab at telling us what depression is? And again, there's 1,000 right answers here. But yeah, Barbara.
I think for me, it's based on being afraid.
Fear-based.
Yeah. So somehow depression, in a sense, keeps me safe.
Yeah.
If I'm depressed, I can't really kind of exert myself. I can't kind of go out there. And I can't be curious. I can't connect. So if there's a sort of a surrounding myself with the cotton batting of depression, if you will, that makes me feel like I'm safe. I'm not really, but that's sort of what I tell myself. So the fear that's under that is I can't do those things that I really want to do, or I won't do them well, or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Something will go wrong for
yes,
sure.
Yes, yeah, inevitably.
I guarantee it, yeah.
Another piece of it is being stuck,
yes.
You know, for me. It's like, I could be afraid today, but then believe that I won't be afraid tomorrow. But when they're depressed, it's like, there's no hope.
Yeah.
You're going to be stuck forever.
Yeah.
You know,
like dwelling in the dark place.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And dwelling in whatever is sad or painful or you know, makes your soul hurt. That's where you're kind of stagnating. You
yeah.
know?
And then I could never get out. That's my fear, is that I'll always be here.
It's fear-based. I get what really wraps it up for me with my own extensive experience with my own depression is a feeling of impending doom that I can't seem to pull myself out of. You talked about being cheerful once, and it's one of these things where it's really hard for me. It's harder to be cheerful if I'm depressed. That's how I define depression.
I think at this point I should clarify one thing about this chapter, and that is that, you know, severe clinical depression, he's not really addressing in this book. I mean, you know, there's medical formulations for that. But he's really depressing, he's really expressing what Trungpa called early morning depression, where we just kind of wake up and, you know.
The blues.
The kind of blues type thing, yeah.
Well, it's like a sense of there's just no more hope.
It's not worth trying.
Yeah. What's the point?
Yeah.
It's
just
turn
over
and
go back.
One of those is
right.
Right. For no reason at all. Right. How do you get feelings like that in bed? Like nothing's happened in the day.
Yeah.
No one's done anything to you. You haven't even left your room.
Yeah.
And yet you already are unable to move and think and act about yourself.
That's reflecting
amazing.
On the past, like you said. Like that's focusing on past. Oh no, today's
going to
be like yesterday.
No. So, yeah, I think we're going to move on here. That's a wonderful description of depression from everybody. And one thing that the Sakyong says here is that it's involved with a suspicion that we're not all that good. That, you know, something's fundamentally mistaken in us or fundamentally wrong. And did you see that? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That there's some, and the Shambhala underlying premise is that our underlying condition is completely good. That, and we call this basic goodness as a defining element of the human condition. Now, you know, we could be obscured in any number of ways. We could be struggling against this, that, or the other thing. But you know, rock bottom, it's a case of goodness. And, you know, this is what we work with. It's easy to say it intellectually, and it's harder to believe it and act on it and trust it. And he says it's also true of society. Also in this chapter, he's talking about how depression can infect an entire society. And guess what he says about our society? That it's pretty depressed. That so much of materialism is driving a depressed culture. He talks to a chronic nullification of our spirit at the national economic level. Anybody believe that?
Well, I totally believe it. And to me, this comes back to, for me personally in my life, I'm sure a lot of people struggle with this idea of being where you are and being who you are.
And I don't think in that kind of society that you're describing that we can make a living and still do that. That's my life
goal. It'd be really hard to make a living and connect with basic goodness? Is that what you're
saying? No, this comment about be where you are.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to do that.
And then be in this society that you just described. Yeah. That's why we're depressed.
I saw a picture of someone in our society and he looked so cheerful. I've never seen anyone look so happy and cheerful. His name is Bill Gates. And I'm like, no wonder you look cheerful. So, point well taken.
But it's an illusion as well, though. So we know that money doesn't buy happiness. That money doesn't buy happiness or that wealth or whatever. That's why we're depressed, is because we believe that, right?
Yeah. Money buys
us. We inherently believe he's happy because he's wealthy.
And that's part of what keeps us stuck from taking risks, perhaps, or stepping out. But there is a relative truth to that.
And there are a lot of things that money can do, not just for yourself, but for others.
Well, Bill Gates does some of that too, yeah.
He does.
So, the next question I want to ask in this little discussion of the chapter is, I think we've sort of said this in a way, but maybe we could outline, why is depression a problem? What's really happening to us as we...
We're not present.
We're not what?
We're not present.
Not present, that's part
it's
of it, yeah.
It's self-perpetuating. Once you're depressed, you kind of get more depressed or stay depressed if you stay in that spot.
And how about with others?
Right, you take less of an interest in others. You're lost in your own isolation. I will put it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then maybe those others, what might happen to them?
They'll become depressed.
Yeah.
Or they'll isolate you because they don't want to be around you because you're a bummer.
Yeah, that can happen too.
You know?
But there is a certain contagion to this that he's talking about.
I feel like it just is a big spread of indifference. Like when you're depressed, you become so hopeless and then you're just indifferent about what happens to you, what happens in the world, because you feel there's no way anything you do will ever matter.
Yeah. That was very well said.
Well, it almost makes me want to kind of stop talking. But
see, Rosa?
I don't know, typically in these Buddhist talks, we tell the bad news first to get you interested or something. In the book, he says, the depressed, aggressive state becomes the norm. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what you're saying, I think. And in terms of the contagion of it, too, that it becomes a kind of norm that we, bitch and complain.
Well, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. If I spew nasty words at you, you're going to spew nasty words back at me. And see, it was just like
He is a creep, just like I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then in the workplace, sometimes people speak to you because you are cheerful.
Then,
you can't win, you got to go down with them.
There's a guy at the lunch station. We always microwave our food at the same time every day. And I persist in saying hello to him. And he's like, how are you? And he's like, fine. So I'm not sure at some point I might just give up, but that wouldn't be the Scottish way.
And the final thing, or a sort of final thing that he says about what's wrong with depression is that it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're, a vast amount of effort going into sort of keep this pump going, pump of negativity.
It's a funny paradox, too, because it's like we think that being the opposite of depressed is going to be too much energy, you know, and like it's totally not. It's like the depression is where all the energy drain, like, comes from for me, right?
Yeah, because the cheerfulness, then you're letting things in. Mm-hmm. You're letting other people's
feelings
in.
Your,
yeah.
It's like, why would I do that? Yeah. Why am I going to put forth that much effort?
Yeah. 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 I have to put all
this
effort in.
It's not going to be worth it.
Okay, so maybe it's time to talk about the opposite of depression. But we're not there yet. The opposite of depression, as told in this chapter anyway, is not cheerfulness. But the opposite, in his understanding, is what he calls elation. Mm-hmm. Elation is a cranked up fun, which we mistake for contentment. Anyone catch what I'm talking about here?
Could you repeat that, please?
Could I say it again?
Yes, please.
The opposite of depression is not cheerfulness. Cheerfulness is going to be a middle path between these extremes. But the elation is the extreme of, you know, cranked up fun and mistaking that for contentment. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Do we have cranked up fun?
It's what happens when you have some little carrot that says, it'll be better over there.
Yeah.
It's short-lasting.
Short-lasting.
Lots of fun, and then you go right back.
And materialist.
But that moment of elation at the beginning, you know, have like 10 seconds or whatever, it's really great. And then it starts.
Well, you might have a whole TV show, or you might or you might have a trip to Paris.
It lasts longer in the pubs as well.
Yes.
It does in Edinburgh.
And he says, this is happening because we're desperate to alleviate our depression. Mm-hmm. So we search for entertainment. So kind of...
Does that all sort of... It feels like that all sort of comes from the outside, though. Yeah. It's not from inside, necessarily. It's more like I'm getting my ego fed by shopping or drinking or partying or sex or whatever. You know, I'm getting my ego fed at this exact moment in time kind of thing. But it's all from the outside in. It's sort of how I'm... Am I getting that correct?
Yeah, and... Yeah. I don't think it has to be commercial. I mean, I think forms of elation could crop up in a relationship.
Well, people have religious experiences.
Or religious experiences,
really high from it, you know, and this is how I should feel all the time.
Yes.
You know? And
he even goes so far as to say you can get elation out of Shambhala. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So you can use it as a crank up to sort of boost your ego and think you feel better. So it's a danger everywhere. And he says, by the way, culture's happy to comply. But it's a pretense that depression does not exist. But he says, let's face it, both depression and elation are forms of bewilderment. We don't know what's happening. We just get on the merry-go-round and ride that horse of elation. And he says that in terms of society, he views human history as having cycles between depressed periods and elation. And he said the way it usually works, you probably can guess this, is that depressed society needs war.
Right. Mm-hmm.
To kind of get into an elation state, boost the economy, and
and to feel better than someone else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're better than them because we're more just in what we're trying to.
Although I have to be devil's advocate here at this point, because this chapter, we studied this up at Shambhala Mutton Center at Winter Dachten. We happen to have a historian among us, and he challenged this. So, I'm not a scholar.
The cyclical theory of
history and society. So we had a very lively discussion about that. But I don't know if anyone here has a historical background.
A little bit,
yeah. But I think it's an area you have to be very careful writing about that.
Yeah, well, okay. I'm certainly no expert in history. And I think he's got a general point somehow.
Right.
Yeah. I have a question.
Yeah.
So the middle's cheerfulness. Where does cheerfulness leave room for grief, like the movement of grief?
Yeah, we'll get to that. Let's remember that question. Right. That's very solid question. But I want to make a little excursion here into another topic just for a minute for those that have worked with this book, Turning the Mind into an Ally. And there's obstacles to meditation that we feel too lazy or forget what the instructions are, and a number of other things are outlined here in great detail. This book being Turning the Mind into an Ally, also by Sakyong Mipham, is a kind of manual for meditating and what happens to us during meditation. And he says that once we get past laziness as an obstacle, maybe our first few weeks or something, that the main obstacles we face are, guess what? Those same two extremes. We face them in meditation, depression and elation. Except in the meditative case, he likes the word laxity instead of depression and elation. And it's the same thing, though, that we, in the lax phase, we really can't do much. Who cares about coming back to the breath? Just kind of going to sit here, and maybe thoughts will go away if I don't get too excited, and maybe it's going to be kind of blah. And then elation is when great things happen. You really do get on that jet plane and go to a tropical island or whatnot, or meet your lover, or discover a new medical treatment or something, cure cancer. All these wonderful things you can do in the elated state of mind. Anyone here has worked with these obstacles and could tell us something about it?
I found that, like, recently I started to think that my meditation was stagnant.
Uh-huh.
But when I don't meditate, I really notice it. Like, bad. Like, I go, like, I turn into Crazy Jackie. And so I'm starting to find, like, maybe that balance, you know, between those two.
Remember
on purpose, but in looking for the elation in my meditation by being, I'm stagnant, why am I not getting this elation in my meditation? So when I miss a day and going to the complete opposite end of the spectrum, kind of finding that balance and like that it is not stagnant if I'm, as long as I kind of show up.
Okay. Remember when we were meditating at one point I said, you don't want to be too loose or too tight. And you can sometimes feel that with a little experience. You can feel that in meditation. So actually in finding the balance in meditation between laxity and elation or looseness and tightness, we're actually working with the cheerfulness because we're, again, looking for that middle between the two extremes. And so I think I'll leave that topic. Those that really have this book and are working with it might want to, you know, contemplate the connection between this and chapter 11. Okay, so we finally come to the real topic, which is cheerfulness. And as I said, it's the middle path between the kind of depressed state and elation. And This corresponds sort of to awareness on the cushion. Awareness, by the way, is said to be the remedy or antidote for elation and laxity on the cushion. And its analog in real life, everyday life, is cheerfulness, is actually a form of awareness. You could space out by rejecting your thoughts, and you could space out by grasping toward the make-believe. That's the sort of extremes we've been talking about. But he says the problem there is that both of those forget or overlook our basic goodness and the basic goodness of others. And so I'd like us to really contemplate that for a moment. What does it mean to say that we could find a middle ground if we actually pay attention to and really relate to and believe in our own basic goodness? Let me give you a quote from Trigyam Trungpa. He says, cheerfulness, and this is a quote, like many of the quotes in this book are Sakyong Mipham quoting his father, as in this case right here. He says, cheerfulness is synonymous with confidence arising from our trust in basic goodness. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. For me, how I in my head relating this right now to, like, how does this relate to you? I think of, like, when you're driving and somebody cuts you off.
Yeah.
And you want to be mad and you want to flip them off and scream yell. Then I try to, most of the time, not always, make the conscious choice of saying, I don't think maybe they meant to do that. Maybe that was a mistake. They weren't paying enough attention.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't mean, it wasn't personal. They weren't trying to get me.
So you're relating to their basic goodness right there.
Yeah, and then I say to myself, being mad at them isn't going to hurt them. It's going to hurt me. So why bother to be mad at them?
Yeah. Have you heard that? Poison is like, I mean,
yeah.
Anger is like drinking poison and hoping your enemy will die.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Anyone else want to take a stab at this?
What's your name?
Lindsay.
Oh, but did you have your hand up?
No, I was just curious if you had anything to add.
Well, what I was thinking about when you were reading that was just how I feel like I have an easy time seeing the basic goodness in people I don't know very well.
Uh-huh.
And then
how about people you do know?
Yeah, you know, people in family, or that you're encountering every day. It gets
it's more difficult.
And I just, yeah. It's just strange how that is. That's what I was thinking.
Very true, yeah. Or often true, anyway. So you have, does that mean you find it easier to be cheerful with strangers? Or?
Yeah, I think, or when I think about, I think one of the most challenging people in my life is my stepmother. Yeah. And when I think about her in the abstract from far away, I can feel cheerful about it. And then I get up close with the reality. And I don't feel
true. Okay. That's the most reality-based comment we've had.
And you probably think we're all pretty basically good, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and also not just reality, it's like the stories that we have about people that I start developing because I am around them a lot. I have an ongoing story.
Well, you know things about them, so you've got the mental construct that you can play with.
We think we know things, I've noticed that a lot of what I think I know is that wonderful word, assume, which makes an ass out of you and me.
I think it can help to be very curious and fresh with every encounter because of the past is giving you evidence about who somebody is that you have believed.
Mm-hmm. The past is giving you evidence, which might be completely phony.
It may be completely phony. Yeah.
And it doesn't. It's not fair because it doesn't give. We're not giving each other space to change. We change all the time. All the time we're changing. So to kind of see somebody, including myself, in this sort of static way is
aggressive.
It's unkind. Mm-hmm. It is unkind mm-hmm. to do that.
I think we all have just our own personal, private, maybe even subconscious list of people we like and that we don't like. And I think that, you know, when I come to a place like this, I want to be the kind of guy that, like you say, remembers people are basically good. And if I don't like them, then that's my journey, is to try to find the reason why I don't like them. Is it because they remind me of myself? Mm-hmm. Is it because I don't have enough information? And so it helps me a lot to try, like what she was saying, traffic's a great place to practice.
Yeah.
To yeah. remember that people might be suffering, that they're suffering. And that do I really care about their suffering, or do I just care about me? And me where I'm going, because if I'm just caring about myself, then I'm just adding to the paranoia and depression, and that's not cheerful. So I'm trying to be cheerful.
Yeah, so cheerful is really making allowances, as you say. That was very really nice statement. Thank you very much. Being really open to the possibility that it's a good world and we're and we belong in it, and others belong in it, and it's our home. And let's make it a nice home.
The more I think I know about people, the more claustrophobic the world seems.
Yeah.
That life is a certain way.
You've built a whole lot of boxes and the fences. You build enough fences, you'll be fenced in, right?
Yeah.
In my personal life lately, in the last 6 months or so, I've really been trying to be excited about people's uniqueness and really, you know, I may not have anything in common with, and you might not normally be somebody that I like, you know, but I try to get excited and enjoy the uniqueness of meeting people who are not like me or my friends or my
I like what you were saying there, because it reminds me of, because
Scott
said people that you like and people that you don't like, and I think you're describing the other group that I've been noticing a lot recently, the people that I ignore.
Yeah.
Or the people that I don't really care about one way or the other. Mm-hmm. You know? And it's sort of shocking when you actually realize, oh, I've actually been doing that. I've been sort of like just censoring this person out, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure the guy at the lunch station, I'm one of those people from, if not directly annoying, you know. So I think that's a lovely, lovely approach, people's uniqueness.
I want to have one more little topic here that I think will interest a lot of us, because a lot of us are concerned about environment. And so there's a statement in here, middle of the chapter somewhere, page 108. When my father was asked how we can help the environment, he would say the same thing when various people asked him this. Quote, "We have to cheer ourselves up," unquote. What is that? What does it mean? Somebody says, how can we help the environment? And the only answer is to cheer up.
What comes to mind?
Go ahead.
Please. I just will say, what comes to mind for me when you said that was the connection between love and wisdom.
Go on.
And so if we're a cheery society, we're spreading love and light, which is wisdom, and that will raise the consciousness of people to ultimately, hopefully, look at those things and take them more seriously. Yeah.
And what were you going to say?
There's something very much along the same lines as far as just like smiling to a stranger. You know, it's most likely they will smile back.
Mm-hmm.
And it is contagious. Mm-hmm. And, or just nodding your head and acknowledging someone that you normally wouldn't. Like, I'm from Los Angeles and people don't even look at each other going through the city.
Yeah.
And it's very different coming from Colorado and seeing people who are so friendly. And it is contagious, that friendly smile and something so simple.
I'm reminded of the quote about just be, I think it was it Roosevelt? I don't know. But just because you can't help everyone doesn't mean that you shouldn't help anyone.
Yeah.
You know, at least one, you know.
I think Eleanor Roosevelt said
that.
Yeah,
I
was
going to
say. There's a lot of Roosevelts.
I know.
Anyone, did you want to say anything?
I didn't. I'm sort of soaking it in.
I wanted to touch on a point, which is one aspect of cheerfulness is that being depressed or being belated is such a waste of energy and time. And if you could hit that right, that spot in the middle, then you can really be effective in terms of, you know, making connections with people. And,
you know, I can't really testify to this, but everybody who really knew him says that was the way with Trungpa.
Yeah.
He was on that middle spot all the time. I think it even says that in this chapter somewhere.
Well, in getting away from the depression, if you're in the present, you're more likely to help your neighbor. You're more likely to help other people, which in the trickle-down system will help the environment because maybe you pick up some trash or maybe you help somebody out and they are homeless, so they are living living in garbage and, you know.
It's almost like be the change you want to see, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Be the change.
It's just been a profound thought to me lately, you know, like, because that whole being stuck in depression for so long, and it's not worth it to try to do anything because it's not really going to change anything, you know, like, it really does, just smiling at someone or picking up trash. Or...
That's a good point. I was just thinking when you brought up cheerfulness in relation to the environment. There's a teacher who's coming to this country called His Holiness Gyawan Karmapa. He's teaching in New York, and I read the blurb for one of his talks, and he said, compassion is so important. He's very strong on the environment, and he talks a lot about it. And he says, compassion can prevent the burnout. So if we have that compassion and that cheerfulness, if we can cultivate that energy and have that resilience, then you don't get, you know, tired of protesting or whatever, you know, why bother, you know, it's not, you know, oh, another of those animal rights activists.
Exhausting.
Yeah. Oh, you can't help all the elephants and the, right, the, you know.
Hey, the circus today gave up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 3 years from that.
Yeah.
3 years for phases, but still, I mean, that's huge. That's a huge thing.
Yeah.
Well, it's like if you look at the environment on a global scale, it's hopeless and depressing and like feels so out of your reach and awful. And if you look at it in terms of what you can do every day and in your personal life, then like your actions and the people you surround yourself with, like you can make a small difference.
So,
I have a huge love of dogs, and if I think of all the stray dogs that I cannot save, but we just adopted a new dog, and it's like this whole like, he's just like, it's like smiling. He just smiles all the time, you know. It's like if I
of course
just,
he does. He just got a dog.
home.
He's bad. Someone said rescue animals are grateful animals, and you know it.
Well, I have to begin to wind up now. But see, this is what I mean. We put the depressing stuff at the beginning of the meeting, and then right near the end, we bring in the cheerfulness, and it seems to work. I mean, I want to just end up with the final two sentences of this chapter. Appreciating where we are right now is a helpful antidote to depression. What comes from that is joy.
So is that to basically help us be consistent? Because I feel like that's how I flip-flop. You know, I'll be either complacent or I'll be slacking and then I'll overdo it.
Tribulation.
I'm always flip-flopping.
Yeah.
It seems like that middle path is really based on just making it part of your daily life.
It's part of your daily life. Now, let us not forget that I wouldn't be able to talk about this if there wasn't meditation in the background.
Yeah.
Can you acknowledge her question about grief?
Oh, yeah, the grief question. Oh, yeah, so, yeah, that's right where we are right now. I'm sorry, I totally...
Because, like, it speaks to what he's saying. You're going to have hard times and you're going to have good times, so, you know.
I think you are speaking to it just fine. So.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't...
No, that's great.
But sort of in relation to what you were saying about meditation practice, that provides a vehicle.
Yeah.
Just being present... For me, just being with my breath, after a little while, I just start to kind of cheer up. It just feels good. I'm here with my mind and my breath, and nobody is bugging me.
And here's what middle path means in meditation. Or at least to me, this is what it means. It's a middle way between following a thought, that is indulging a thought, and pushing it away, pretending it's not there. And if I have grief, you know, I have those two choices of completely pushing it away and pretending it's not there, or going, you know, overboard into a complete me plan about my grief is so important, you know. And the middle path there is somewhere in between. I don't think we have words for that. Very thing. There's your cheerfulness.
Well, even I think coming back to that thing I shared initially about allowing those feelings, not making a problem out of the feeling of anxiety and the unknown and the fear, not making a problem of that, was a form of contentment because it was a form of allowing and loving.
So cheerfulness doesn't mean you're not going to have negative emotions,
right.
Either arising internally or coming. From some external source. And we're not totally fooled by them either. But also, it doesn't, you know, it's an equal danger positive emotions. You know, somebody's dies, but maybe somebody's born. And you could go overboard on that too.
Yeah. I have, but it's a microcosm experiment. I'm a Seahawks fan. Okay, so I'm watching the Super Bowl and my team caught the ball on the 1 yard line, and I will call after this learning session elation.
Yeah,
I was elated. We were all elated. A moment later, they passed the ball and lost the game.
Yeah.
One play, entire season gone. That was depression.
Yeah.
Okay, so then I caught myself right at that moment. I remember it very well. The feeling. A feeling just so, and I know it's a silly thing to grieve over. It's just a game, and it's a bunch of millionaires. But I was grieving. It was genuine grief. You know, I invested my emotions and spirit into this team, and I immediately started listing the things I had. You know, I'm still here. I still got a roof over my head. This has absolutely nothing to do with here, right here, here now on our farm. I can turn that off, and it's like it never existed. So I start to make a gratitude list of things that I have, and I find that depression, I can become cheerful faster, I guess is what the way it is.
Gratitude is wonderful.
Yeah.
I just want to say something more about grief, that grief, as I understand it, is a journey. And it is different for every person. And so there might be days when the feelings are overwhelming. And there might be days when you feel like you're not grieving. You know? And I think the one thing I've read a lot about this, because I'm interested in death and grieving, and I volunteer with hospice. And the one thing I read again and again is, it's your grief, it's your journey. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I would say that meditation would be very empowering in that, in allowing you to experience whatever your own experience is there.
There's a lot of power in going someplace and acknowledging it, but not dwelling there.
Yeah.
You know, saying, I am very sad that this person or thing or, you know, pet or whatever that I very much have feelings for and love, you know, passed away. And it's another thing to wake up every morning in that space and live your whole day in that space, you know, so you have to...
Yeah, I would say...
In your own time.
Yeah, I really would just say it's very, very individual. There are people who experience chronic grief, which is a different sort of experience, but, yeah, it's...
Yeah, mine is more of that's coming up from my childhood that has been returning with fear.
Well, just try to remember the middle way.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have
should
to
stop.
Do we dedicate the mirror?
What I would suggest is we do a Shambhala bow.
Oh yes. Okay. So
we were touching on gratitude a moment ago. I want to express gratitude to Walter for helping us with this.
And one way we often start and finish events in the Shambhala world is with a mutual bow. It's not like a pianist that bows to the audience, but the audience just sits there. We actually all participate, and it's a kind of mutual acknowledgement of respect and basic goodness, a way of acknowledging that all the way around the room. So just take a little bit of a exaggerated posture here, and then in many contexts there's somebody who's sort of leading it just from the way the evening's set up, and for me, for tonight, that's me, and here I go. Okay, announcements?
Just very briefly, thank you all for coming. We are here every Thursday night, just about every Thursday night. I think we skipped Thanksgiving.
Christmas,
I suppose, yeah. We also meet here on the first Sunday morning of each month, but not the other Sunday mornings. So
this Sunday morning.
Yeah, but this last Sunday.
If you're on the mailing list, they send you announcements.
Yes, so if you get on the mailing list, then you'll see announcements of everything that's coming up. And we do some things besides our meditation system. We do other things in the community, and social things.
Lots of things. And if you decide to take out a book, please remember to put your information next to your name.
Yeah.
And keep it as long as you feel that it's helpful, and then return it when you can.
And for those of you who didn't see it, there's a magazine rack right by the door, and those magazines are free to take. You don't have to bring them back if you don't need them. Just take them.
I feel elation for bringing them back.
Well, thank you everyone for good help.
Blue on the bottom of the big pants, the very bottom of the floor, and then black on the upper.
Is that black? No rules for blacks.
Nope.
What color?
Yeah.
The light blue one?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it doesn't matter, huh? Yeah.